Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is Carl Safina, who is Dr. Safina, an adjunct professor at Yale. And you have lots of official kinds of things behind your name, all of which seem to have to do with a deep concern for those things living on the planet, some of whom are not very familiar to us. Bill was saying as we went away that often when we see the sea, it has mammals, whether it's dolphins or people, and then there's everything else. We have some growing to do on that front, don't
we? Well, we have a definite air breather bias. anything that breathes air in the ocean, we love. We love whales and dolphins, uh-huh. but we also love sea turtles, which are reptiles, but we love them because they breathe air. If they were plesiosaurs swimming around underwater...
Who's a plesiosaur?
Well, actually, plesiosaurs used to breathe air as well. Those are the aquatic dinosaurs.
Yes.
So if they were still alive, we would probably love them too. But I guarantee that if sea turtles had gills, we wouldn't like them so much.
Well, no fooling. Isn't there sort of a speciesism in this?
There
it's a little bigger, but...
A definite speciesism. And if these fish that I talk about in the book, with the extent to which the populations have plummeted and the depletion and the declines, if those things had lungs instead of gills, they would be on various endangered species lists. And
they are not.
There would be all kinds of concern. And
things like the bluefin tuna. You made me love a bluefin tuna. Now, I confess that I am attentive to Dolphin Safe, but the idea that I should care about bluefin tuna had not occurred to me. Why is it that...
It hasn't occurred to most people, but then again, you probably had no concept of a bluefin tuna. And most people know tuna from meat in a can.
You bet.
Steaks on a grill.
Mm-hmm. Good steaks.
Yeah, very tasty. I eat more seafood than probably anybody that I know. I'm not against eating seafood or using what's in the sea. And I think there's nothing wrong to use it, but there is something wrong about using it up. And that's what I object to, is that we're using it up. But, most people's concept of what a tuna looks like when it's alive is Charlie the Tuna on television commercials. I mean, most people probably could draw a whale or a sea turtle and probably could not draw a tuna in a way that is recognizable. They just have no clue as to what they look like. And yet these are some of the most remarkably evolved animals on the planet, the most highly evolved fish in the oceans. They're superlative creatures in many ways. They're absolutely perfectly adapted predators. They are long distance migrants in ways that rival and exceed any birds. And what people know almost nothing about them.
I don't want to get too far in the detail. I was fascinated by the heat engine and the functioning of that. And
can you say a little more about a heat engine if we're going to talk about this?
That's why I'm asking, not asserting. Can you do a quick course on what's going on
and why we should care?
Yeah. Well, one of the most remarkable things about the tunas, and the bluefin tuna brings this to the most extreme point of development, is that they have a way of keeping their blood and bodies warm by taking the very small amount of heat that's generated in the muscles through muscular movement, and as that heat is flowing out toward the gills where it will be lost to the ocean, the blood enters an extremely fine capillary system where blood coming in the other direction picks up that heat and brings it back into the muscles. And in that way, the fish creates warmth inside its body in a way that it would not be able to do simply by generating it metabolically, because as the blood, all the fish's blood has to flow through the gills in order to pick up oxygen. It has to flow through at such a rate that all of the heat would be lost to the surrounding sea. And so it needs a way to take the heat out of the blood before it gets to the gills, but it can only take the heat out because the blood, of course, has to stay in the blood vessels. And the fish has a system designed to do exactly that.
This is a very sophisticated heat exchanger.
It's the most sophisticated heat exchanger
and very efficient
in the animal kingdom.
And very efficient.
Yes. I was very struck by your storytelling ability. My congratulations to you to take things like a heat pump in a fish.
Make it interesting.
Riveting. And I'm learning from you that this is a young species, that they weren't there when when the first hominids showed up.
When the first hominids showed up, there were not bluefin tuna yet in the oceans. So that's when I say that they are a superlative type of fish that is near the end point of fish evolution in the present of life on Earth. That's what I'm talking about. They're new.
It's also very easy. I can hear people saying that's very interesting. You know, if you're a scientist and that's what your PhD is in, you got to make a living somehow, then by all means do the research. But really, why should I care? I mean, you know, if it's not tuna fish, I'll find something else to eat. If I don't eat tuna fish, I'll eat salmon. If I don't eat salmon, I'll eat grouper, whatever. There are big businesses that have done very well capturing and selling tuna. Why should I care?
Well, there's a whole variety of reasons. In the most selfish way, the reason you should care is because this stuff tastes great on the grill, and at the rate we're going, we won't have it anymore.
That's pretty self-interested.
It doesn't get a lot simpler than that, and you don't really have to appreciate much in order to have the concern that if you like it, it's headed in a direction that won't support your habit in the near future. The other thing is that these fish as animals are part of the incredibly rich biological endowment that makes life beautiful and full of wonder. And to the extent that we know about it, it is the extent that we enrich ourselves with what's available to make life meaningful to people.
You make the salmon really personal. Now, the salmon has done a pretty good job making itself personal to maybe millennia of humans. Isn't some of the challenge with all of these fish to make it personal, to get it out of the abstract, to make it something that we think about that I should care about?
Well, it's not just getting it out of the abstract. It's just getting it into view. Mm-hmm. Most people, I mean, you don't have to change the concept of what they are. Our concept of what they are is so flawed that it's just a matter of seeing them. Mm-hmm. They do their own sales job. You don't have to package them in any kind of fancy or metaphysical or different perspective. All you have to do is say, look at these things, and they speak for themselves, really.
I'm going to carry that a little bit farther, and I'm going to quote you. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary, you say, of the environment. Or you maybe you quote somebody else saying that.
I was paraphrasing somebody else who said it. Tim Wirth said that.
Well, thank you, Tim Wirth. It helped me to be thinking about, here's a scientist, you, talking about the environment, no surprise. And all the way through your book, you're talking about things that are deeply related to the economy. Like the fish that isn't going to be there for me to buy if it's all gone. Mm-hmm. Like 90% depletion of all kinds of things that people are having individual lives directly affected by the fact that if you go fishing and don't catch it because it isn't there, you're going to lose your boat. The economic factor of this was quite striking. Did I get the right picture from your book? Are we looking at human economics too?
It's not only human economics, it's human well-being at, in some cases, a very basic level. In the places I was in Southeast Asia, those people are confronted very directly with malnutrition and the threat of worse malnutrition as a result of the depletion around them that they have caused unwittingly, that they are now realizing they need to reverse. In the Philippines, there are people fighting not only for their own health, but their own political freedom. And they realize that they have to get back the viability of the coral reefs around them. Otherwise, they'll have no economy. And without an economy, they will have no ability to have self-determination, which in their case means to them political and religious freedom. So it's everything from health and economics and community and society and ideology that people rely on natural resources for. And in the stories in this book, it's in many cases very, very directly do they rely on those natural resources.
We sort of jumped in, I think. There are a lot of people that probably don't understand the importance of reefs.
Of what?
Reefs.
Coral reefs.
Coral reefs.
Mm-hmm.
And what their role is in all of this, and what the current status of coral reefs are.
Coral reefs in the late 80s were discovered to be declining in many parts of the world. It's probably the first case of an ecosystem type that is in decline on a worldwide basis. It's very alarming to a lot of scientists who work on it. It's very baffling. There are new diseases that not only have they not been discovered before, but it seems like they would have been discovered before if they were there in some places that are fairly well studied. So it looks like the reefs are under lots and lots of new stresses that have been intensifying in the last 10 years or so. And people are very split as to what the causes are. I think the causes are multiple. I don't think it's just one thing. It's everything from the global warming, which right now the Earth is in a naturally warm period, and the corals are living at the upper end of their temperature tolerance. So any additional warming on top of that stresses them. So some people have said that global warming is the root cause. Other people have said that it is the ecological disruptions that happen due to overfishing and the imbalances that occur on the reefs, which clearly is contributing. If you take out all of the fish that eat algae, for instance, you have these explosions of algae and the coral cannot survive.
Can we talk more about coral when we come back in just a moment? We are talking with Carl Safina, who is the program director of the Living Oceans Program at the National Audubon Society, which is also an interesting thing to talk about. We're going to be back shortly. Bill Russell and I are speaking with Carl Safina. This is the Paula Gordon Show, and we hope you'll stay tuned.